As usual, we save our most exciting topics for last, and I would be happy to give the floor to Javed.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to implementation matters. I turn your attention to agenda papers 12A to 12C. These papers discuss the proposed amendments to IS 8 regarding accounting policy changes. The proposed amendments aim to simplify the application of accounting policy changes resulting from agenda decisions published by the Interpretations Committee. The board published an exposure draft earlier this year that proposed to lower the threshold for retrospective application of such changes. Agenda paper 12A summarizes the proposed amendment, explains the process we followed for analyzing feedback on the exposure draft, and outlines the objectives of this meeting. Unless there are particular questions or comments on matters discussed in that agenda paper, I will move to the next agenda paper. Any questions or comments on paper 12A? All right. So agenda paper 12B analyzes feedback on the status of agenda decision and the board's decision not to amend IS 8 to address the timing of application. I will first talk about the status and role of agenda decisions. The status of agenda decisions was not the subject of the exposure draft. Accordingly, most respondents did not comment on their status. However, some respondents said the challenges the board is trying to address arise from the status of agenda decision and not from the requirements in IS 8, and so provided feedback on this matter. Paragraph 14 to 20 summarized this feedback. Such feedback links to matters of due process, and we intend to report it to the Due Process Oversight Committee, together with the board's views on this matter. The Due Process Oversight Committee is in the process of reviewing the Due Process Handbook, so this feedback will form part of their consideration in that review. Paragraphs 21 to 42 include our analysis and conclusions on this matter. We first assessed the role of agenda decision and where agenda decisions fit within other material published by the Foundation. We think agenda decisions play an important role in supporting consistent application of IFRS standards without undermining the principle-based nature of those standards. Our analysis goes on to explain why we think the current status of agenda decisions is appropriate. In particular, explanatory material in an agenda decision explains how to apply the requirements in IFRS standards. The content and style of this material is often similar to that of illustrative examples. It refers to applicable principles and requirements and often links those principles and requirements to relevant explanations provided in the basis for conclusion and other accompanying material. Accordingly, we recommend retaining the current status of agenda decisions. We also plan to recommend making some enhancements to the description of agenda decisions in the Due Process Handbook. Those suggested enhancements are noted in paragraph 41 and 42. Now, with that, I would like to direct your attention to questions 1 and 2 on page 18 and ask you first if you agree that the current status and role of agenda decisions is appropriate, and second, if you have any views on our analysis and conclusion in paragraphs 21 to 42.
Anne?
Thank you for the papers, and I think that they set out clearly issues about the status and role of the agenda decisions. And it's an interesting set of feedback that we've received, because as I look at the feedback, it suggests to me that there is some confusion in the communities about the role and status of agenda decisions, which might suggest that we need to re-examine our communications with the various stakeholder groups. To outline, because I think it's quite clear from the materials that you present what the current status and role is in terms of the action of the agenda decision in identifying relevant standards and other materials in guidance and illustrative examples. So the agenda decisions are identifying those materials that are relevant in the cases where the committee has decided that standard setting is not appropriate, that the answer is there within those materials. And so if that's the activity, well, then the status needs to stay as it is now. We can't change the status. because it's a reference point to things which are mandatory. There's no need to make agenda. It's inappropriate. You wouldn't make agenda decisions mandatory. So it did. I think the arguments for maintaining current status are clear. But one thought that did come to me was that perhaps some people are not clear in the stakeholder communities on that.
Daryl?
So I'm comfortable with the idea that it shouldn't be mandatory. I don't think we should change the status. I was a little bit concerned with the wording that you've got in 42, and specifically 42.2. I think it's more of a semantical issue. We mention elsewhere that one of the reasons why we would typically consider an agenda decision not to be indicative of an error is that it is bringing new information in that the preparers did not previously have. And I think the way that we've worded it in 42 at the moment felt to me very much like we were making it absolutely clear. The words were there. You should have done it that way. You should have. And I think whatever we come back with, I think it would be useful to bring out that point about new information.
Mary?
Maybe I'll start by picking up on Daryl's. I think he's right about getting the kind of the two legs of our views captured together. One is that I think others also share this view, that the whole process of outreach, assessment, analysis by the staff, discussion by the very well qualified group that is the interpretation committee, that overcomes the weakness of its chair, that brilliantly chaired. All that together really does perhaps for many give new insights into how it's all knit together. But I think it's also very important that the material cannot add to or change requirements in the standards. And I think that cannot add to or change requirements is something that each party involved has to discipline the other about. Mm-hmm. And it's part of what comes out of that discussion about exactly how far you can go in terms of what the IFRS standards actually say. And, it was interesting to me in reading this. I was pleased that I didn't see anything in here that suggested that people think that that's a line that's being crossed or not honored. So that wasn't part of the comments. And sometimes we have to think about what some of the comments are that we're not getting. And I think that was an important one. But I think we have to continue to discipline ourselves, because I think it's very important that we continue to have agenda decisions as useful tools, but not make them mandatory. There's some of the operational and process arguments that the staff has included in the paper. I think very important is the one to me in paragraph 34B, that it would put IFRS standards into a state of perpetual change, if we were doing this. And also, I think we've got the right balance with agenda decisions in terms of deliberation, limited exposure, but not the wordsmithing that is important that we do when we are writing authoritative documents. I mean, they aren't done casually, they aren't done sloppily, but we don't have the same deliberation over each word that's in there. And I think that also is part of the process. It's why they are a useful tool that isn't prohibitively expensive for the system to produce. So I support the recommendation of keeping them non-authoritative. I agree with Daryl. What?
Non-mandatory.
Non-mandatory, sorry. Yes. But I think we should not make them mandatory and therefore part of the requirements of our IFRS standards. And I think we should continue to keep the balance that we've had. But I think we also have to keep reminding everybody about not going beyond what's in the standard. And if people think that standard setting is needed, that's a separate recommendation to be decided on.
Amari?
Thanks, Sus. All right, I very much agree with the paper. paper, and that's the recommendation. I think this is absolutely fundamental for us, including to have the good benefit of the interpretation committee. I have only one comment, not disagreeing, but only suggesting for you to take into consideration when discussing with the POC. Some of you do know that I'm not very fond of negative forms. And when it comes to paragraph 42A2, you start say an exploratory material, and then we start cannot. So we, instead of saying what it is, we start saying what it is not. So I would prefer personally to say what it is. I think it's an explanatory material, explain how the applicable principles and requirements, as it, you have in the same paragraph. If we do believe it's important to say what it's not, I would only put at the end of the sentence. I think it's much better. But I totally agree, and this is only a personal preference.
Gary?
Me too. Thank you. Over the several years of the interpretations, my views of gender decisions have changed. I think it has a lot to do with the great leadership of the current chair of the committee. but I think, but when you step back to look at way we write standards, there's a certain format they follow. You start off with scope, and then you go through recognition and measurement, then might go to subtopics, you know, say in leasing, lease term, variable payments, and so on. But they're written in an order with that topic. With that subject. However, the real world doesn't neatly fit transactions inside one standard. And so oftentimes the agenda decisions, you know, the staff is triangulating through several different standards and various paragraphs and standards and basis and so on and so on. It effectively connects the dots without adding new words to it. So, I mean, there's no decision that comes to the Interpretations Committee that's easy, because it wouldn't have gotten there if it was clean. And certainly reasonable people can reasonably differ also, because usually the first reason something in is diversity. So my sense is this is the best reading of the top accountants about how to approach a given specific question. And as long as we're connecting the dots through multiple standards, you think when we write standards, the staff has consequential amendments and all those sorts of things that work. This really is no different. I think the due process is about what's appropriate. And I think this is consistent with the spend more time on maintenance and make sure you get consistent applications. So I think we've got the process right. I don't think it needs to be authoritative, because as long as you're connecting a lot of dots that are in complicated different places and say this is the way, and voila, here it is.
Yep.
As others, I mean, I support basically the recommendations here. Just a few comments. Wherever it is located, I think it's important to state that any explanatory material cannot add anything. So I agree that we don't eventually start with that, but I think it absolutely needs to be there, in my view. I would be tempted to refine the wording in 40A2, because I would want to emphasize the fact that what an agenda decision is identifying, in fact, the relevant requirements, not only in standards, but also in their accompanying material, and those that are relevant to the analysis of the fact pattern, because I think that's what we are doing. And maybe it's in doing that that you can introduce that it is this, when you do this perspective, that you bring new information, so that that comment would be picked up. I'm also wondering how you should deal with what happens from time to time when, in fact, the interpretation committee provides a conclusion to the analysis of a particular fact pattern.
I think we've come to the point where it is meant to be done in exceptional circumstances, but shouldn't that be, I mean, if we go to that level of detail in the due process handbook, I think it would be a relevant aspect to deal with so that we know when this should be done or not done, or done at all. The last point I was, I had a question about this notion of those agenda decisions which are explanatory and those which are not, because lately I've seen, I mean, am I right in saying that what we've seen lately, I mean, last year or so, or even 2 years, are all of them were explanatory?
Certainly most. There are one or two that are not, and maybe the one that's just come to mind more recently that isn't is, there was one where we had a question on dual currency bonds, where we did two lots of, we did outreach, and then also in comment letters, we got it confirmed that that's simply a transaction that is not widespread. And so we did finalise, or sorry, the committee finalised an agenda decision there that just said we were asked this question, but through outreach and comment letters, it was confirmed that this is not widespread. Therefore, the committee did not take on. So,
okay,
it's certainly on the rarer side, but there are some times where.
Okay, but that's what we mean. It's not new information on one hand and no new information on the other.
No.
Okay. Wanted to make sure that it was the case.
Sure.
I'm sure you'll be unsurprised to hear that I agree with the that we shouldn't change the status of agenda decisions, but I think a few important points have been raised, and I like the suggestion the staff are going to make to the Due Process Oversight Committee that we add some additional clarity in the handbook about what an agenda decision is and isn't. Is first, because I think it will help us with the communication point that Anne raised. I think that there's confusion, and I think we probably ourselves in our own language have contributed to some of that confusion, because I think we need to get in the habit of talking about the fact that the agenda decisions don't have the same status as the standards. Mm-hmm. It's not that they don't have any authority, and so I think we need to sort of become more disciplined, and this will help our process. I like some of the ideas that Francoise had, actually building on Daryl's suggestion, that I think they can add additional information, which is Daryl's point, by pointing to existing requirements that are relevant to the question asked or something like that, but cannot add new requirements. And I think there's a nuance there that we don't capture, which would be a good addition.
Denchow.
Thank you. I agree with staff's proposal. I think the status and the law of the agenda decision is appropriate, and it has played a very important role to help people to understand and implement IFI standards. I also agree with Anne's point that whether we can improve our communication. But I think when we made this amendment and to include them to in handbook, I think people will much more aware about the objective and what's the intention and what we are doing. So I think it will help to improve the communication. I have one observation with regard to the recommendation of the amendment to handbook of paragraph 42B, where we are proposed to, you know, to amend the handbook to distinguish between the agenda decision that include explanatory material and all others. I'm not very sure that, because handbook, I think it's at a high level, you know. I think whether it's necessary to amend the handbook to address these kind of specific issues, and whether it's really necessary to distinguish those different agenda decisions, and also to address what kind of title, name should be giving those agenda decisions. I think it's better to give some flexibility to help us to draft and provide agenda decisions in the future.
Anne?
I also wanted to comment on this idea in 42B of naming agenda decisions as explanatory or not. I don't think we need to do that. I think it's abundantly clear where we've said standard settings not necessary, short paragraph, versus one that goes for a couple of pages pointing to various materials. I just don't think we need to do it.
So we only have to vote on question one.
Yeah. Question one.
support your staff recommendation.
The status of the agenda decisions.
That is everyone.
Everybody? Okay, you're right.
Thank you. We will now discuss the timing of application of agenda decisions. Paragraph 45 to 54 summarize the feedback on timing. A majority of those who commented on the timing of application agreed with the board's decision not to amend IS 8 to address this matter, and also said that the board's view on this matter, as set out in paragraph BC 22 of the ECPUSH draft, was helpful. Nonetheless, some of these respondents suggested including the board's view in another location, such as in IS 8 or in the due process handbook. Paragraph 55 to 66 provide our analysis and conclusion. Based on our analysis, first, we recommend that the board not amend IS 8 to address the timing of application. Second, we suggest documenting the board's view in paragraph BC 22 of the ECPUSH draft. And third, in terms of location of that view, we think one of the locations in which that view could be documented is the due process handbook. That is not to say this would be the only location in which it could or would be documented. The board could still, for example, document this view in the basis for conclusions to IS 8 in addition to the due process handbook. So with that, I will turn your attention to the questions on page 27. And I'll ask whether you agree with our recommendation not to amend IS 8 to address the timing of application, and whether you have any views on our analysis and conclusions on this matter.
Can I just step in and just pick up on something Javed said, because I think it is an important point about this point about where to capture the thinking about the timing about the application of agenda decisions in the handbook. And as Javed said, we weren't envisaging that would be the only place we would capture that notion. But we just thought that it's got to kind of naturally belong there as part of the description, if you like, or the explanation, that formal description explanation of agenda decisions. And we were thinking that if you have it formally recorded somewhere there, it then acts as a hook that can be used in other, you know, more accessible, approachable materials that we might have on the website or in any brochures that we produce around implementation. So that was a little bit more of the thinking around that. It's very consistent with the way that today the handbook is the place where it formally records that agenda decisions don't have the mandatory status of IFRS, but often include helpful, informative, persuasive material. We then use that in other materials. So it's just to reassure that it wasn't the only place, but the formal way of recording it.
Daryl?
So I appreciate that clarification, because I think that helps me think about it. I was really concerned about the idea that there might be something in the handbook that was potentially overruling something in the standard. I think what that does do, and sorry, by the way, let me just clear it. I do agree with three, so I agree there's nothing further we should do from a board perspective. I think if we're going to put this into the handbook, and it would still not be my first choice, but I agree that it could be helpful. I think it puts a really important point on making sure that the words in the handbook are identical to the words in the standard. And we just need to be aware that we may be introducing something new now. So we've got, we know in the hierarchy where the words in the standard are. We know pretty much in the hierarchy where the words in the basis are, where this is likely to be. We almost need to think about where in this hierarchy of applying IFRS words that are in the handbook go. And it's just keeping that in mind as we sort of go through. And I think we need to be very careful of just having differences in words in different places.
Anastasia?
Well, I agree that with your recommendation in question three, so that we wouldn't deal with the timing issue in IS 8. I wouldn't mind having something in the basis for conclusion if that was possible, but I would want it to be different from what we had suggested, because what we had suggested sounded like we're not obliged to do it right away for yesterday, but for the day tomorrow it would be. So I would welcome it with some other language. But I wouldn't regard this as being sufficient. And in fact, what I would like to introduce or to recommend be introduced in the due process handbook would be a supplementary duty for the interpretation committee to provide a form of indication of the time that might be necessary to implement a change that might be triggered by the issuance of an agenda decision. Because I'm still concerned, and I don't think we should leave issues just, you know, being facing, in fact, how things are enforced or regulated in their jurisdiction, and eventually being imposed for a quicker implementation of something that still has a voluntary application status. And I also do not think, because the objective is to foster consistent application, I don't also think that it should take forever. So, you know, something that would absolutely not look like an effective date, something that would be more a form of estimate that a possible changes could be take up to a number of months, or I don't know what the wording should be, something that is rather loose but still indicative, and so that would be an anchor in practice. And I think it would be, I would regard that as really helpful. And it would also, in fact, bringing that in the handbook, I think it's where it belongs, because that's where we explain how the Interpretation Committee, the ISP, should work. So to me, it is, I thought it was a good solution.
Changwu.
Thank you. I agree with the step recommendation. However, one thing on that kind of scope of question three, if we have an issue, so if we have issued an agenda decision, that's even though non-mandatory, it's exploratory. Entities, preparers can respond in various ways. They can change their accounting policy. But the entity must correct their errors because of this information. Well, sometimes the entity can change estimates only. But what I'm saying is that our exposure draft is only focusing on the voluntary accounting change, accounting policy change. But this paper is related to the due process handbook. So it seems to me the scope is a little more, becoming more general. Any kind of responses from the preparers, even though we don't amend anything on this timing, but we shouldn't restrict the scope is a kind of a only accounting policy change from the, some agenda decision. So we need people to be general.
Martin.
Yeah, and I agree we should not have this timing in changing IS at 8, but I think this idea is included in the due process handbook. I find also a little bit strange, because then, as a preparer, I have never had the idea to look at the handbook and get an idea when I have to, when I have to follow a agenda decision and change my accounting. And therefore, I think it's not so clear what we want to achieve. Man, if you want to communicate it more to the public, I think this place is not the right place. Man, if you want to have it somewhere to get, I don't know, maybe that is, but I think we, if we're doing that, I think we need another way to communicate that with permanently where can people can find it. I'm against that because I think, as I said, man, I have never looked at this handbook before I joined this organization.
And Martin,
therefore, it's not a place where people are looking for guidance when they have to time to apply an agenda decision.
Yeah. And Martin, that was my point, really, because I don't think it's actually that visible in the putting it in a basis for conclusions either. So if ultimately we don't do standard setting, I thought let's have the description of agenda decisions in one place and then use that to make
on the website. Then
would have looked at as a preparer.
Website, maybe in a frequent update on more places where agenda decisions are talked about.
Tak.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with staff's recommendation. And I think actually our proposal already built in the kind of self-policing mechanism, which is written in the paragraph 63, which says that longer the time that elapses between the publication of agenda decision and application, that means that is no longer the new information. So therefore, they automatically it decides the timing that the entity should apply the should apply the new accounting policy. So it's already built in this good self-policing mechanism.
Gary?
I also agree with the agenda decision. I could probably support if we decided to put an IES, but I do think it's got to be in some place that's prominent and accessible, and whether it's the due process handbook or some other place, I'm kind of a bit indifferent, but I think it should be prominent. In some of my comments, they might actually lapse over to 12C, but I'll say them now. I think, you know, as a preparer, if something landed in my desk and said, here's your agenda decision, you got to deal with it, is it's important that we communicate you don't necessarily have to deal with it the next reporting cycle, which could be a couple weeks, you know, after it's published. And if that was the case, if I really had to adopt it right away, because that's what GAAP always was, and we'll deal with the restatement issue separately, is what I would do, if I didn't want to do it or wasn't ready, I would dig in and say it doesn't apply, is what I would do. And say the facts are different, whatever it is, or it's immaterial, or whatever, because I need time to digest it, what does it mean? But the minute you do that, you've locked yourself into the standard doesn't apply. Excuse me, the agenda decision doesn't apply. And therefore, it truly becomes a voluntary change way down the line when you do it, if you do it at all. But if the objective of these things is to get to maintain our standards, have consistent application, so on, you can't expect it to be done instantly upon arriving. In that sense, I'm actually a little bit more concerned about that than how do you box in the back end of it. But I think that's a consequence of not getting the word across. You don't have to necessarily do it right away.
Daryl?
So I think just having listened to the conversation go around, I may need to clarify the clarification. when you were talking about it appearing elsewhere, was the intent there that it would appear in the handbook as its primary point of reference and then the elsewhere sort of educational type material?
I think we are thinking it, yes, educational type, but it could also still appear in the basis to ISA as well.
I guess my real concern when I raised this originally was, even if it is communicated as widely as we needed to communicate, I struggle a little bit with the idea that I may need to look at something that is in the handbook in order to understand how to apply a standard. So I may have looked at IS 8 right now and said, IS 8 says this is a big deal and my accounting is bad and I need to fix my accounting. Oh, no, don't worry. The handbook says it's okay. I don't have to do what IS 8 says. And it's that link that was really worrying me. And I felt that we needed something somewhere in the IFRS book that made that clearer, unless what we're thinking about is that we would educate people to say, the book says you don't have to do it.
Would putting it in the basis of 8 achieve that for you?
That's why I was very comfortable with the basis. I just wasn't too sure when you started to answer the questions going around the room, whether we were actually thinking that it would only be in the handbook and everything else would be supplementary materials to point people towards the handbook.
And I think, as you say, I think 8 is, you know, a home for it, by the way, even regard, you know, we're not asking you today and we need to bring back for discussion, obviously, the question one and the overall ED. Okay. But I think what it's just to test out your thinking is almost the basis of 8 is a slightly unnatural home for it, because if there is any change that results from an agenda decision that's published, an entity, even if it's not directly thinking about it, it's going through almost IS 8 in terms of what is that change? Is it a change in accounting policy? Is it a change in accounting estimate?
If it's in the book, I'm very comfortable with it. And then I wanted to pick up also on Francois's point, we've discussed this before, so this is not the first time I heard about it, and I really initially quite liked the idea of us asking the Interpretations Committee to say, well, this one's going to be a little bit harder and that one's going to be a little bit easier. And that would sort of point people towards understanding how long they took. But I think, having sort of thought about it a little bit further, my concerns around that are twofold. The first is it requires the committee to do a lot of additional work. So there'd need to be an assessment of how hard. And then I think we end up with a problem that we, to a certain extent, have with standards when we think about transition, is that we always have to take, to a certain extent, the weakest case. Who's going to take the longest and give an indication of that? And I think for a lot of this, there's going to be a real mixed case. So if the interpretation committee comes out and says, we think you should be able to do this really quickly, but I personally have a major problem with it, I don't know how I deal with that discrepancy. And equally, and this might be a little bit of Gary's point, if the interpretations committee comes out and says this is really hard to do and we expect that people will take longer to do it, then if it's easy for me, I'm just going to sit back and wait because I've been told I don't have to rush. And so I worry about whether we are consuming time from the committee without getting much benefit in terms of actual application. And then I think the other problem I've got is that it pushes us a little bit back towards the idea of thinking of these as mandatory. Because I'm giving you an indication of the timeline, I'm sort of also giving you an indication that I expect you to do it. And that was the other concern I had around it.
Mary?
I support the staff recommendation to that the board recommend to the trustees that they consider adding this to the due process handbook. Because I think it is good if we can answer the question, well, where does it say that? You know, if we have a description of the interpretation committee's activity, purpose, product, et cetera, and we say, you know, the agenda decisions have the following characteristics, they don't have these other characteristics, and here's what the expectation is in terms of how they support the objective of improving consistency in application of the standards, although not being standard setting mandatory requirements. And, you know, if we, as Henry says, have places that we explain things, if somebody says, oh, where does it say that? I'd like it to be something authoritative. And I think the suggestion to include it in the due process handbook makes sense as an authoritative one that doesn't prevent us from saying it elsewhere as well, either in official things like the basis for conclusions bias 8, you know, and or elsewhere, even if, you know, some of that microtype that we put in IFRIC update and et cetera, when it talks about agenda decisions. So I like the idea of putting it, you know, of encouraging the trustees to think about putting it in the description of agenda decisions. There's a comment in passing that didn't, in the paper, paragraph in the 50, I think, that said some encouraged us to write it into the timing, into the agenda decision itself. And I don't think, for a lot of the reasons Daryl added, even about Francoise's softer version, I think for all those reasons, we should not think about doing it either explicit timeframes or I think I shared Daryl's concern about even indicative expectations as Francoise suggested. I think this is a time to rely on kind of market discipline of its informative, maybe new piece of information in terms of thinking about the issue. You have to decide how relevant it is to you, how big an issue is, and how long it takes you to do it properly and make a decision. Because one of the other points that was raised, covered in the summary, that influences my thinking about that is the point that it may be clear in some cases I have exactly the fact pattern submitted, but there will be other issues that you may say, now that I understand the thinking on the fact pattern there, it makes me think about something else that's somewhat related. And there's a better articulation of it of that point in the summary. But I think that that's one of the things that people raised about some of the problems with distinguishing agenda decisions from other voluntary changes. And I think it's relevant on this point of how much can we indicate expectations, not just who's the weakest link, but also the range of circumstances in which it might read. So I think I do not support trying to make any kind of comment on a decision-by-decision basis about our expectations, even qualitative, for implementation.
I agree with a number of those sort of specific concerns that have been raised about this idea that the committee would opine on an indicative timetable, but I am empathetic to the concern about doing something to assist the preparers in terms of their discussions they might have to have with auditors and regulators about what's reasonable, because I don't think any of us think they should have to do it tomorrow, but what can we do to help them actually achieve that? And I wonder whether something to think about, because I don't think we have to decide on this today, but something to think about, which is sort of a bit of a blend of Francoise's suggestion but also the other comments about visibility, would be thinking about whether it would be helpful if it were something as limited as repeating in the final agenda decisions the reference in the due process handbook that acknowledges that people are, whatever the square bracket, expected to have sufficient time to implement the agenda, okay, the agenda decision, so that it's right there on the page, visible. It means it's visible. It's not adding anything, but it's a reminder. It gives them a basis, at least, for the discussion. It's better than nothing. It's not as helpful as saying X months, or putting it an update every time at the top of the final agenda decisions, because I think that would mean it's visible. It's not opining, but it's reminding.
Yeah, I can see the good arguments against my good idea. and I would appreciate everything that we could do, because I think we have received pretty good response about that something had to be done. So to the extent that we can go. I very much sympathize with what Martin said, that the due process handbook is where you find the duties of us and not the duties of preparers, and not necessarily the guidelines for regulators. So if it could be in the systematically repeated, that would be great. There is another place where we could have that, which is in the introduction to the annotated book,
and the decision.
And in particular, in the section that deals with the yearly edition, so where you have the new elements that people are going to consider. So that could be a place to put things. And a last remark that I would like to make about, and I'm sorry because it relates to the status of these decisions, but I've come to the point where I wonder whether questioning their status is even relevant, because when you have something that includes authority that in fact is a collation of authoritative material, do you have to specify the status?
Like a practice statement?
I think that's one of the points, right? Because we're just cross-referring to mandatory stuff.
Exactly. Tom?
Just a small, quick question that just occurred to me listening to everyone. Just sort of who you're speaking to. I think Mary actually put it kind of more in the active voice, more about the preparer. Mary, correct me if I'm wrong, but entities ensuring that they've taken sufficient time to do a proper implementation without undue cost. You could do it that way. I'm not saying Mary said that, but she gave me the idea. What we've written is it should be allowed, and Sue said, talked about regulators and auditors, and they should have sufficient time, and implicitly allowed by whom, or given sufficient time by whom. And I'm just a bit worried that it sounds like the thing speaking to the auditors and regulators as opposed to speaking to the preparers. I don't know if you have a comment about, which is why I did that. If it's the preparers, they need to take sufficient time to do a proper implementation.
I think the initial commentary, correct me if I'm wrong, was almost more, I suppose, maybe directed at the wider IFRS community in a sense, in saying that, you know, if an agenda decision is published, and let's say, for example, in June, that, you know, covers a transaction that particular companies have, that I'm sure it's not that they, you know, the company themselves, if it potentially takes some time or some work for them to think about it, to think about whether the change affects them, but, you know, whether it means a change in accounting policy, etc. So it wasn't so much directed there. It was hoping that practice as a whole, in a sense, would allow those types of companies sufficient time to prepare to implement that change. So I suppose an answer to your question is, I think it first and foremost wasn't necessarily directed towards the companies themselves, but more towards
the community to allow them.
Yeah.
Okay. I sense that we continue to agree with our previous decision not to amend IAS 8.
To work on visibility.
Then we go to the next paper, Shalani.
Yeah. Thank you. Paper 12C. Agenda paper 12C summarizes feedback received on other aspects of the proposed amendments. As a reminder, we are not asking you to make any decisions on these matters at this meeting. However, we welcome any questions or comments you may have on matters included in this paper. Respondents expressed mixed view on the proposed amendments. Paragraphs 13 to 49 summarize the main comments raised, and Appendix A summarizes other comments. In terms of the main comments, many respondents disagreed with or expressed concerns about the scope of the proposed amendments. Those respondents suggested that the board extend the scope to all voluntary changes in accounting policy. Secondly, respondents expressed concerns about the application of the proposed threshold and said that applying the proposed threshold could be both challenging and costly and might be difficult to audit and enforce. Lastly, some respondents expressed concerns about the board's decision not to amend IAS 8 to specify whether a change resulting from an agenda decision is the correction of a prior period error or a change in an accounting policy. With that, I would like to turn your attention to the question on page 15 and ask if you have any comments or questions on the feedback.
That does not seem to be the case.
Well,
or yes, Françoise?
If I may, if it's not delaying the day too much.
No.
just a few comments. I was of the view originally that the relaxation should apply widely. And so I'm very sensitive to the comments that we've received in that direction. I ultimately also think that all the clarification that we made around the gender decision were very helpful materials. So I wouldn't want this to be lost. And then considering the comments received, I wondered about different things that we could be doing. And I was wondering, in fact, whether we should not revisit, in fact, the interpretation of impracticability, because there is the widespread understanding that originated from not this place, but from Cannon Street in the early years, that it meant an impossibility. So that is this interpretation, in a way, that has created the problem. So I was wondering whether an interpretation that would relax that notion would not be a possible way forward. I was surprised by the comments that we received from people saying, don't relax anything. Because they seem to, given that the comparability issue was raised thereafter, they seem to read our recommendation as if people would move from full retrospective to prospective, and I don't think that's the case. And we have in standards ourselves when, in fact, relaxed the full retrospective, keeping a retrospective application nevertheless. So it's not as if we were giving people the possibility of doing the wrong thing. And I think that's particularly well supplemented by the guidance that's there. I don't think that, by the way, that this guidance should be lost either. I think we should keep it in a way or another. And another possibility that I could see is that apparently people don't have a problem with undue cost of effort, which in my view remains a relative notion. So if it's relative to something, it's, I think, relative to benefits. But if people are more comfortable with that notion and we would still have the guidance behind it, why not?
Mary?
Thinking about the issues raised, you know, we've already talked about making agenda decisions mandatory or not. I'm trying to avoid getting smacked for using the wrong word. and I think this paper, I think we can then move on to just assessing the issue of should we be differentiating changes that relate to agenda decisions from other voluntary changes or not. I think we should not kid ourselves that for some people those are interactive questions, but I think some who wrote encouraging us to make agenda decisions mandatory would have said that and will probably say it in respect of a due process handbook or some other consultation. So while I think there is interaction, I don't think we should expect that we will respond, you know, and fully satisfy the, you know, the calls of those who were looking for mandatory. It doesn't change my view about the decision, you know, the preliminary decision we just made. But I think we shouldn't overstate that, you know, ask the staff to be aware of that when they bring back the analysis of should we revise the scope of the exposure draft in terms of not differentiating agenda decisions or not, because that seems to me to be one of the things that we're likely to discuss as a follow-up. On the point about the feedback we had about making this cost-benefit determination, I think there are two strands that it might be helpful to bring back in the follow-up analysis. One is those who have to make it and those who have to audit it being worried that it's hard, it's another judgment they have to do, will they get second-guessed on it? And then a second strand that says, I don't want it to be an entity-specific determination. I want to know that there's comparability. And I think those are just two strands that fall under that category, and they should be analyzed separately. I'm not saying I buy into and we have to respond to all of them. I want to think about it there. And I think probably in that setting is the setting in which it might be helpful to look again at our considerations around doing something different, the cost benefit at an individual entity level versus, let's say, guidance or amendments on impracticability or a decision to use undue cost and effort. Now, I think we'd have to put undue cost and effort into an entity-specific determination, which might address that people uncomfortable with making judgment side. But it would not be at all responsive to those who want greater degree of comparability. That isn't me, you know, I'm not encouraging that we go that route, but I just think we have to think about where, you know, which of the responses these things map against. And it almost seems to be a point of religion that users always want restatement, and because trend information is so important, and I think that was the feedback that we heard in part from regulators about this. How could we even consider not having something apply retrospectively? But I don't always hear such a uniform response from users of financial statements, because over the years I've heard some say, "I'd rather know what the impact is." Of making the change, and what the, you know, and some estimate of what the impact will be in future, rather than having the past restated again and again, it gets lost. You start paying attention, etc. So, I don't think it's as clear as it's always what users want. And I think we should maybe try and bring in some more nuance in that consideration. I don't know if there'll be an opportunity, for example, at a CMAQ meeting to perhaps just have an open discussion about that point, not necessarily in the context of this specific amendment, but just testing that point again, because I think it's gotten kind of ingrained over the years.
Yeah. Any other comments? No? Okay, thank you very much. Then we go to the final paper of this week.
By the way, I'll just say thank you very much for that on 12C, because we can obviously feed that into the paper that we bring back to you. Everything we heard today on 12C, we'll feed it into what we bring back for discussion when we bring analysis.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon, everyone. Agenda paper 12D discusses the proposed amendments the board has tentatively decided to include in the annual improvements to IFRS standards 2018 to 2020 cycle. Paragraphs 6 to 8 summarise the proposed amendments and the board's discussions and tentative decisions to date on these proposed amendments. The board has not yet considered transition requirements for the proposed amendments to IFRS 1. Paragraphs 9 to 17 of the paper analyse the transition for the proposed amendments. Based on our analysis, we think transition requirements are not relevant for first-time adopters. We also recommend that the board does not permit or require previous adopters of IFRS standards to apply the proposed amendments to IFRS 1 retrospectively. I would now like to draw your attention to question 1 on page 8 of the paper and ask if you agree with our conclusion and recommendation.
Is that the case? That is the case.
14.
Okay.
The next step, paragraph 19 to 23, discuss the due process steps relating to the proposed amendments to be included in the exposure draft annual improvements to IFRS standards 2018 to 2020 cycle. I would now like to draw your attention to questions 2 to 4 on page 9 of the paper and ask first, does the board agree with our recommendation to have a common period of at least 90 days for the exposure draft?
14.
Secondly, does any board member intend to dissent from the proposed amendments to be included in the exposure draft?
I don't think so.
And your last question for 2018, is the board satisfied that it has complied with the applicable due process requirements and that it has undertaken sufficient consultation and analysis to begin the balloting process for the exposure draft?
14.
Well, this resounding result, we close the final board meeting of 2018 and we look forward to 2019.